We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 43. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we're talking about tribal capacity building to support sovereignty. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nuuch, or Ute People's Treaty Lands, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Dr. Ashley Spivey on the podcast. Dr. Spivey is the Executive Director of Kenna Consulting. She's an economic anthropologist whose research focused on archaeology and economy in Native communities. Ashley's academic and professional experience has been largely focused on cultural resource management and preservation in Indian country. Ashley specializes in cultural resource management, museum management, historic and ethnographic research and analysis, program development, and grant writing. Her collaborations with tribal communities and outside organizations has resulted in over $1.5 million in grants, supporting tribal initiatives and institutional collaboration with tribal communities. Snaps, by the way. Ashley is an enrolled member of the Pamunkey Indian Tribe. All right, and just a note that Dr. Spivey is at home recording. It is currently July of 2020. So that means that she's home with her kids and her husband and her dog. And so occasionally you might hear some noises in the background. So our apologies for that, but that is just life right now. So all the fun challenges of being a working mom during a pandemic. So thanks everyone for your patience if you hear any fun background noises. So welcome to the show, Ashley.
Hi, Jessica. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. I'm excited to talk to you. So, okay. Yeah, you know, sometimes I do an intro, but I think I just want to dive right in. What got you into this field?
So I got interested in the field, I guess, as a kid. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, which is about an hour southwest of my tribal community, which is located in rural Tidewater, Virginia. We have a small reservation. It's about 1,200 acres. That's in King William County. So even though I didn't grow up on the reservation, I grew up very close to my community, and my family lived there, my grandparents, my aunts, my uncles, my cousins. So it was a place that was definitely a big part of my life and always has been. And having the connection to the reservation is kind of the foundation of why I got interested into the field of anthropology and archaeology. Two things about that. I mean, our reservation, we have been one of the lucky indigenous communities in this nation that has not been completely removed off of our ancestral territories. So this is a place that we have occupied since time immemorial. And even though it's only relegated now to 1,200 acres, it's still within that core space of our homelands. And you literally cannot walk on our reservation landscape without finding an artifact or something that one of our ancestors made, you know, from 50 to 100 to 1,000 years ago. So you can't not help but be a member of this community and be down there, you know, in our reservation community and not have some kind of interaction with the material culture of your ancestors. So that was one thing. And it had always fascinated me that I could actually touch it. It's like a tangible piece of our history that you can pick up off the ground and learn from. And in addition to that, I come from a family of Pamunkey tribal members where several of us, several of my ancestors have been tribal leaders over the last two centuries. One of our tribal leaders was my great-great-grandfather, George Major Cook. And he, along with a lot of other family members, actually created a large collection of archaeological material from the reservation and also from just objects that family members made, like pottery. We were boat makers still at that time in the early 20th century. So boat paddles, beadwork, all of these things that our folks were still making or the things that people were finding in the ground, he collected. Or if people from the reservation or even from his associates outside of the reservation, if they found something, they would bring it, you would bring it to the chief. And at that time, there was no, you know, cultural center or community center, right? If you were going to come to the reservation and socialize, you went to the chief's house. So he actually had a special room dedicated in his house to this collection that he had amassed throughout his lifetime. And that collection was actually passed down from, you know, to his son, who was my great grandfather, Tecumseh Deerfoot Cook, and then my grandfather, Warren Cook. And that collection that has been in my family for over two centuries is actually the foundation of the materials that were put into our museum that are here on the reservation that was opened in 1980. And my grandfather was the director and curator of that museum for about 30 years. So I also have that experience directly in my family, and then also being able to go to this space and place on our reservation that tells our story from our perspectives through our material culture. So I've been exposed to these things my entire life, really. My grandfather, as I mentioned, who was directing the museum for 30 years, he had a lot of associations with anthropologists and archaeologists. We've actually had quite a bit of work done in our community over the last century, and that includes definitely the last 30 to 40 years. So he also had close relationships with several anthropologists and archaeologists. So for me, from an early age, really, I was able to witness the use of the field in a positive way for my tribal community. And I've always been interested in history personally, history in general, and definitely the history of my tribal community. And seeing kind of the material world related to that history has always fascinated me. And it's just, you know, when I got to college, I went to James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. I decided that that was the route I was going to take for my career, is to help tell the history of my people. I think one of the founding moments for where I really, you know, I'm going to be honest, I changed my major like probably like five times when I was an undergraduate. And I think one of the things that, you know, I guess helped me solidify my decision on to follow this path was I was working on some research as an undergraduate on the history of our ceramic tradition. We still make pottery here on the reservation today. We've never stopped doing that. We are honored and blessed to have potters, you know, that still exist here in this community and could still teach that traditional method. So I was with my grandfather actually at the Smithsonian. We were at the National Museum of Natural History, where they do have a pretty large collection of Pamunkey objects. And we were reviewing some of the pottery from the 19th century that they had. And we were there with one of the folks who works in the collection there. And she had made a comment to my grandfather, like, you need to be careful, don't drop these things. And my grandfather said to her, what do you know? You're just an anthropologist. And if you knew my grandfather, you would know that that's a typical thing for him to do and say. He is not afraid to speak his mind and say what he feels. So I read between the lines when my grandfather had made that statement, you know, that these were the things that our people had made, and that this person didn't really have the right to tell him how to handle the objects that belong to our people, really. Even though they're in the Smithsonian, they still belong to our people. We made them. And I was also frustrated, you know, that example kind of epitomizes my frustration. When I did start getting into the field, I began to really understand that Native people's perspectives were not taken seriously. They weren't considered the experts, even though they are the experts. They are the ones who are living this history and are the living examples of the history that has come to pass for our communities. And it was honestly made me very angry that elders in our communities would be treated this way, because they're the ones that hold the knowledge. They are the ones that should be considered the experts. But I also understood too that if I was going to further the usefulness of this field, anthropology and archaeology, like I had said, I've seen it used in positive ways for our community. But if I was going to continue that, I was going to need the degrees to be taken seriously in the field. So I made a decision around that time with that experience between my grandfather and the anthropologist that I was going to get a PhD in anthropology and archaeology. and I never looked back. So that's kind of a, you know, I guess a long background story of why I am where I am today and why I chose to become an anthropologist.
Yeah, that's surprising to hear that your grandfather in that day and age did have good relationships with anthropologists and that it was beneficial to your community. Cause like, obviously in that period, there was some bad stuff. And obviously it was a bit of a mixed bag, it sounds like.
Definitely. And if I can even give more context, right, even before my grandfather's time, during my great-great-grandfather's time. So this is right at the turn of the 20th century, right? George, his name was George Major Cook, I had mentioned. He was chief of the time. He served, I think, from 1902 until his death in the 1930s. During that time, and this was also the time when we had a heavy focus on the community from anthropologists, from about the 1870s up until the 1940s, we had several anthropologists, well-known anthropologists like Frank Speck, James Mooney, come through our community and do work with our community. And this was welcomed by the leadership at the time. And one of the reasons why it was welcomed is because at that time, especially in the South, we're experiencing the eugenics movement, which of course anthropology had a direct influence in shaping.
Yeah.
And we were also experiencing Jim Crow segregation. And that is something that all people of color experienced, you know, across the country. But in the South, it wasn't just about an African-American and white issue. If you were not white, you were subject to these laws.
Right.
And that was also at a time in Virginia when the political leadership, the legislators, the lawmakers of the state were actively working towards denying the existence of Indians in Virginia. We call it paper genocide, basically. In 1924, the Racial Integrity Act was passed in the state. And it basically stated, it created a quote unquote biracial state. You're either colored or you're white. There's no in between. And the proponent of that bill, Walter Plecker, had a campaign actively against the Virginia Indian communities, claiming that they were no longer quote unquote pure blood Indians or true Indians, that they were African American, intermixed with African American, which is true. We are a multiracial community. That's the bottom line. But for me, and not everybody's going to agree with what I'm about to say from the tribal community, but for me personally, that intermixing, which was a reality of, quite frankly, of all of our communities, does not negate a tribal identity for me personally. But this is what we were facing in the early 20th century. We were not legally allowed to put Indian on our birth certificates, on our marriage certificates. You could not get married in the state of Virginia if you were a different race, the couple was of a different race. So during that time, the leadership, tribal leadership welcomed these anthropologists because they saw them as a vehicle to demonstrate and show that we were Indian people. So they kind of flipped the coin, I think, at a time when anthropology was doing some, like you said, some really horrible things to Native people and other communities of color. My tribal community looked to anthropology and the anthropologists at the time to help tell their story, basically, from their perspectives. Unfortunately, it didn't help in terms of that immediate moment and deflecting the attention, negative attention that they were getting and deflecting the laws that did eventually get passed and were not overturned into the Supreme Court case, the Loving Supreme Court case in the 1960s. So, but that really is the main reason why I think for the most part, my tribal community has had a positive relationship with the field. And it's also easy to see that positive relationship, too, when you're here on the reservation. You're kind of in a bubble with it because you talk to people who see the value in it. But they see the value in it in terms of it having specific parameters. And that is when it's controlled by the tribal community, when the questions that need to be answered are expressed by the tribal community. They do not look kindly to it when it's somebody from the outside just coming in and saying, I want to do this and it'll help you. So this is what I'm going to do. No, they look at it, I think, from a lot of tribal communities' perspectives that if they're going to engage in this type of work, it has to come from them and it has to come from their interests and it has to serve the community. That's another big factor for me and why I got into the field, actually, is I saw that the field was about serving anthropology and anthropologists and the academy. It wasn't about really necessarily serving Indigenous communities and supporting sovereignty and supporting self-determination. So that's another reason why I decided to get into the field, to hopefully help change that in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, before we get too far from this, you talked about the paper genocide in Virginia, and then you just mentioned sovereignty and self-determination. So obviously there was a group of Virginia tribes that just got recognition, what was that, 2 years ago?
Right.
Was that all because of this paper genocide then? Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can definitely talk about that. So, and it's complicated, so bear with me. Yeah, so the Pamunkey Indian tribe actually got federal recognition. It went into effect, that recognition went into effect in 2016. My tribal community actually went through the Bureau of Indian Affairs process, meeting all seven criteria that where the Office of Federal Acknowledgement said they recognize us, they acknowledge us as an Indian tribe. And we were able to go through that process because, honestly, quite frankly, we're one of two tribes in Virginia that still have reservations. The rest of the tribes do not have reservations any longer. And I think because we've had this land base, we were able to keep our government structure intact, right? Mm-hmm. So we were able to meet the criteria as they stood, you know, prior to 2016. And of course, it took 30 years to go through the Bureau of Indian Affairs process through the Office of Federal Acknowledgement, but we were successful. The other tribes, there were six other tribal communities that were recognized through the congressional process, and they were recognized in 2018.
Okay.
And yes, to your question, yes. The reason why the other tribes had to go through the congressional route was because they necessarily could not meet the criteria as outlined by the Office of Federal Acknowledgement. And a lot of that, yes, had to do with the fact that because of this paper genocide that existed in the early 20th century, because a big part of putting your petition together for acknowledgement is documenting your existence. And it's really hard to do that when you have the state of Virginia not allowing you to put Indian on any of those official government documents. So that definitely played, you know, a part in that. And I mean, but to go back even further, just a quick note, that's not the reason why any of us weren't necessarily recognized by the federal government. I mean, one of the main reasons why we have not had federal acknowledgement is because our treaties are with England. We were negotiating treaties well before the United States was ever in existence. So, and by the time that the United States is established and they are engaging in treaty negotiations with Indigenous nations, you know, we had already been through that. We had already kind of gone through that process with a different sovereign nation, and that was England. And so actually our reservation lands were established in 1646. So we actually have one of the oldest continually occupied reservation communities in the United States. But again, that was done through England and not through the United States. So that had a big part to play in it as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like a lot of the tribes out here with Spain and then and then the U.S. But that was Spain and Mexico and the U.S. And yeah, it gets real complicated. Yeah. Wow.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, that was all really interesting in things that I didn't necessarily even think we were going to get into, but I'm really excited we did. And we are already at our first break point. So we will be back here in a second.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% 50% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code HEVO, HEVO. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Okay, we are back. And we're going to get some more into some of the topics that we were just discussing a little bit later, because it kind of all comes full circle. But for the moment, let's go back to where we left off in your timeline. You decided that you were going to get your PhD, and then what happened?
Right. I started my graduate student work in 2007, and I did it at the College of William & Mary, which is in Williamsburg, Virginia. One of the reasons why I chose to do it there was because it's in close proximity to my community, which I knew I was going to definitely be doing research with the Pamunkey Indian tribe. And I wanted to obviously stay close by. And also it's my home and where my family are. And there's also a really interesting historical tie that my community also has to the College of William & Mary. The college actually is home to the Brafferton Indian School, which is the second oldest Indian boarding school in the United States. Harvard was the first. But the Brafferton, the College of William & Mary, was the second. And I had a lot of tribal members. We have a lot of tribal members that actually attended boarding school at the Brafferton in the 18th century. So there's also, and actually my tribal community had the most young boys that attended school at the Brafferton. So, and that building is actually still standing. It was built in 1723. And that building where they all went and attended school is still standing today. So there's multiple reasons why I chose that school. I just felt that it was, for many reasons, appropriate for me to be there. And I really do feel like getting my degree there, even though it was not an easy journey, it was coming full circle in a lot of different ways for me being there at the time that I was and doing the research that I was on my own tribal community. So my first field experience, real archaeological field experience that I had, was at a site called Werowocomoco. And that was an extremely significant place for the Powhatan people. And our tribal communities that are in Virginia today, that are from the Tidewater region, are descendants of the Powhatan chiefdom. So this particular place called Werowocomoco, it was actually the political center of the chiefdom. And that is where Wahunseneca, who's better known as Chief Powhatan, resided for many years, including for a couple of years when the English first arrived in 1607. So it's a major political and spiritual center for our people. And the College of William & Mary was actually doing archaeological work at the site. And they were doing it in consultation and alongside the tribal communities that were descended from the Powhatan chiefdom, including my own. So again, I was able to see here with the College of William & Mary, with all of these other tribal consultants, being at this place in this space that's so significant to our people and doing work that I think mattered to everybody and it served everybody in some way, you know, shape or form. So that's kind of another, you know, integral moment when I was like, okay, I want to do this. This is what I want to do. And I want to do it at the College of William & Mary. So I started work under Martin Gallivan, who is my PhD advisor, and Danielle Marity Langholtz, who is the director of the American Indian Resource Center at the College of William & Mary. Those were my two main mentors there. And I started with them in 2007 and got my master's in 2009. I focused on the ceramic tradition that my community still has. I focused on the history of that and the value that tribal members put into the concept of tradition. And what does tradition mean to us? And how does the practice of making pottery
reflect those values and those meanings and those perspectives. And then after that, I started my dissertation research. And my dissertation research was a mix of archaeology, oral history, and archival research. I wanted to try to hit all the points that I could to really get a full perspective. And my main focus for my dissertation research was on the 19th century experiences of our people. We know quite a bit, you know, about the 17th century, the colonial period, because there's just a lot in terms of documentary evidence and, you know, work that's been written about that time period. And we know obviously quite a bit about the 20th and 21st century, because that's more of a living memory experience, so to speak. But there's not really that much in terms of oral history and living memory for the 18th and 19th centuries. And there was so much change, especially for Indian country across the board at the turn of the 20th century. I was just personally also interested in documenting that change. What did that mean for my tribal community? What did it mean in terms of their engagement in traditional subsistence? Our people relied on traditional subsistence basically since time immemorial. And it's not until after World War II that we started to see a huge movement away from that. And I wanted to know why that was. And what did traditional subsistence look like? We still have remnants of traditional subsistence today. We still have fishermen. So our tribal community, our reservation, is almost an island. It's a marshland peninsula that's surrounded by the Pamunkey River. So the water, the river, the marshland is hugely important to how we have been able to survive for thousands of years, especially since European colonial expansion. So I wanted, and we still have remnants of that, even though I feel like we're at the end of this so-called transition where there's so very few people left in our community that still do some traditional subsistence activities, right? So I wanted to record that history. I wanted to know what the traditional economy looked like in the 18th and 19th centuries. And then what were the influences and the factors that started that change away from it? And so that's where I got into economic anthropology. I was just fascinated by looking at my tribal community's history through that lens, particularly a political economic perspective, which really foregrounds the way that history, right? And the way that history unfolds and how we are where we are today as communities, as a society, as a nation, is focused on historical context, political context, social context, right? It's not something that's inevitable. There are all these factors at play that impact how our communities change and sustain ourselves over time. And economy for me was just a really interesting way to get at that. So one of my focuses were on, I kind of took a gendered perspective, right? Because at that time, women did certain things, men did certain things. So I looked at fishing, I looked at trapping, I looked at, and that's the man's world, so to speak. I looked at craft production, like ceramics, beadwork, that's kind of the women's world, so to speak. And how the community used that traditional subsistence knowledge, not only to support and sustain themselves here on the reservation and support their families, but how they use that traditional knowledge to engage in a market and cash economy. And, you know, many tribal members talk about the fact that they were able to market these skills and this knowledge is the reason why they lasted so long, because they were able to make money off of them to support their families and their households. So I delve really deeply into the fisheries and the fish markets and the role that women played again in producing ceramics for market. So that's kind of, you know, the research, you know, perspective that I took. And it's extremely rich. And I'm, you know, I was honored to be able to have the opportunity to delve so deeply when a lot of us just don't have that opportunity because we're trying to, you know, live our lives and put food on the table. And I had the chance to sit down with our tribal elders and really talk about their lives and about their experiences and their perspectives. Because it wasn't just about getting you know, their life history, it was like, let's talk about anthropology and archaeology and the role that that field has played in our community. What are your perspectives on that? So while I'm also detailing this very specific history, I'm also actually critiquing the field of anthropology in my dissertation throughout. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, yeah, it doesn't always reflect well on the field of anthropology or archaeology. You know, two mm-hmm. epiphanies mm-hmm. that I had in my graduate career were, one, I know this work can be useful to our community. I know I can take the field of anthropology and use it in service to tribal communities. And the other epiphany I had was, I can't necessarily do that within the academy, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to make light of the folks that are in the academy that do great work, like the Indigenous scholars that we have in the academy, like the folks in academia that very much support tribal initiatives. But unfortunately, that's just few and far between, especially where I live, especially in the Middle Atlantic region. It's just something that you don't unfortunately see often when it comes to actually really with engaging wholeheartedly with Native communities and consulting with Native communities. So I learned like that I wasn't, you know, academia isn't necessarily where I belonged. And I was okay with that because I knew one way or another I was going to try to, you know, try to service tribal communities. And I didn't have to be in the academy to do that. But I think getting those, you know, those three letters behind your name, the P, the H, and the D, I thought that was going to help. And you know what? I'll be honest too. Has it helped that much? I don't know. I think it's helped a lot in terms of me being able to generate this like huge historical document for my tribal community that tells our history from our perspectives. But in terms of like really, you know, digging in and making a change in the way that the academy works and the way that, you know, the state government works when it, in terms of engaging with tribes, I don't know if that's how much that has really helped. I do my best. And that's why I decided to kind of like, okay, I can't do it from the outside. I've got to stay on the inside as much as I can and do it within the communities. Like that's how my community has done it. And I think that's where you see the successful models of where archaeology and anthropology works for Indigenous communities when it comes from the inside out. So that's kind of where, you know, that's what I led into. First, I worked for the tribe. I actually worked for my own tribal community for several years before I decided to do consulting and kind of like broaden my horizons, so to speak, and to work with multiple tribal nations across Indian country.
Okay. So first, I guess the way that you just described your PhD, you know, basically that it was a history of your people from your people's perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm curious about, like, obviously your people were there for like a moment that is really like key in the American like vision of who we are as a people, mm-hmm. you know, with like Virginia and colonization, and like the Spanish were in the Southwest even actually before that period, but it doesn't like resonate in like the story of America for most mm-hmm. Americans the way that like Virginia does, you know?
Right.
But I'd be curious, like, from your tribe's perspective, you know, when you're looking at your history, was this a significant moment to you guys in the way that it was for the rest of America? Was it like, you know, a positive moment in the way that it is for most Americans? Or like, are there other parts of your history that the community would like rather be talking about? Yeah, so I guess that's a bunch of questions all at once to start about all of those things that you just touched on.
Actually, so the Spanish were here in Virginia in the 16th century. A lot of people don't know that. And that the English in the Southeast. Yeah, they established a mission here in Virginia in the late 16th century. They actually came here earlier than that and kidnapped some Powhatan Indian boys
and took them, quite frankly, actually around the globe with them, and came back decades later. These boys obviously were now adults. And the mentality behind that was to kind of help infiltrate, right, to missionize. And the Spanish mission did not last long. The young folks that they had kidnapped and taken around for about a decade or so returned to their communities and led an uprising against the mission. So Spain didn't last very long in Virginia.
Yeah, so that backfired on them.
Yes. they killed off the entire mission except for one individual, and that's the account that we have about what happened. And then, of course, the English came. And the English actually were traversing the Chesapeake Bay region, which is home to our watersheds here in the Tidewater region of Virginia, again, in the late 16th century. So, yeah, we were dealing with European folks very early. Of course, this history, right, this colonial history in Virginia and in the East Coast was very pivotal for our people. And we think it's very important, but obviously the perspective that's told does not resonate with reality, quite frankly, definitely from Native people's perspectives. You know, the focus here in Virginia, we've got what we call the historic triangle. We've got historic Jamestown, which is the fort that was established in 1607 that is known as the quote unquote birthplace of America. You also have Colonial Williamsburg, as I had mentioned, and Yorktown, which was another pivotal colonial place here on the East Coast and was integral in the Revolutionary War as well. So yeah, there's a lot of history here, a lot of deep history that is very important to the building of the United States, right, as a nation. And our people were at the center, not at the center of it, but engaged in it all along the way. And that's, I think, the most frustrating thing for us is that our kind of quote unquote relevance or value when it comes to Virginia's history or the nation's history is kind of bookended in the 17th century, right? 1607, our last treaty with England is signed, I guess, re-ratified with England in 1680, right? So it's that small window of about 80 years or so that we're talked about, that we're mentioned, that we are, I guess, given recognition to having some kind of contribution to history, even though it's a passive one, because it's talked about in ways where things are being done to us, right? European colonialism is happening to us. And we're not active agents, right, in that. Right. And then basically we disappear, you know, in the historical, quote unquote, the historical record after the 17th century, which is absolutely not true. People just don't see the relevance of indigenous people in this region beyond the 17th century.
Magically reappeared.
Right. And we've kind of been, and me personally, I cannot speak for the whole Virginia Indian community in any way, shape or form. And I would never presume to do so. But for me personally, it is so just exhausting to hear the same trope over and over again that's just focused on the 17th century. And even then, what is discussed in the 17th century isn't accurate. And it does not, you know, comprehensively reflect the role that indigenous people played in the shaping of Virginia and in the nation's history. So, you know, even though I chose to focus outside of the 17th century, you know, don't get me wrong in thinking that there is a lot of work that still needs to be done, even though that typically is the focus where Indian people's value, so to, quote unquote, so to speak, is recognized in the historical record. You know, and some of the things that we want to talk about, that we want to highlight, is the integral role that we played, the role that we played in resisting. You know, this isn't, we didn't just roll over and allow this to happen. We had prominent warriors that led uprisings against the colonists to protect our way of life, to protect our land, to stop the English from enslaving our people. You know, we resisted, we fought. It's not something that we just passively, you know, let happen to us. And I feel like that's a way that we're typically treated, you know, when the history is discussed, is that we're just these, again, these passive beings with no agency. We have been engaged and involved in every major American war,
you know, in dealing with prominent individuals like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, you know, in the Civil War, we were Union supporters and guided several Union armies here in the Tidewater region of Virginia because of our traditional knowledge affiliated with its waterways. So, you know, we've had an important engagement and an impact in the state's history. And I would obviously say the nation's history. And I feel like the main message that I always hear, you know, not just Pamunkey people say, but people from tribes in Virginia in general, is this notion that we're still here, right? Because there is this perception on the East Coast, you know, east of the Mississippi, that there are no more Indians, that we were wiped out, or all of us were moved, you know, west, out west to Indian territory. And that's obviously not true in any way, shape, or form. And I think that the way anthropologists and historians have treated the colonial history of Virginia and the region has actively contributed to this notion of disappearance, right? To this perception of disappearance. If you only talk about Indians in a colonial context, for example, that's bookended from 1607 to 1680, yeah, people are going to get the idea that, oh, well, I guess they went away after that. You know, we killed them all, or they were all moved west. So unfortunately, you know, I would say the majority of people in Virginia, maybe up until recently with all this federal recognition news, but did not know that there was indigenous people still in the state of Virginia and that there are two reservations, two of the oldest established reservations in the United States in the state of Virginia. You know, the perceptions that we get, again, my whole life, you know, I don't look, quote unquote, what, you know, a stereotypical indigenous person is, I guess, supposed to look like or supposed to act like from especially white folks' perspectives. But the bottom line is that, you know, we've always been here and people just don't recognize that and haven't recognized that. And I would say that these fields that deal with the history of our, you know, of our country have actively contributed to that myth and that misperception. And so just the general consensus, I would say, is that we just want equal treatment when it comes to the ways in which these histories are taught and explained and written, you know, so that this idea of us not being here or not being real is combated against. And, you know, having to constantly defend your indigenous identity is exhausting, which is another reason why I, you know, chose not to necessarily like work in the field through academia. So that's, you know, that's one issue that we're facing, I think, because of the way that the colonial history is perceived and written about in our country, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, and what you were just talking about there, like I mentioned to you when we were off air, you know, reminds me a lot of what Michael was talking about on the Mashantucket Pequot episode 12, where we have the quote from Trump saying, you know, they don't look Indian to me. So yeah, I mean, definitely a lot of the same themes. We are already at our second break point. Just flies by. So we will be back here in a moment.
Hello, it's Jim Eagle. Please join us for the Bay Area American Indian Two-Spirit Society's 11th Annual Two-Spirit Powwow in person or online this year at San Francisco Fort Mason Center on Saturday, February 12th, 2022. Gore dance at noon and grand entry begins at 1 p.m. There will be over 60 vendors selling all types of indigenous products and crafts. Powwow dancers from all over the U.S. will be competing in contests all day long. We'll also be having several delicious fried bread taco vendors. For more information, go to baits.org. That's BAAITS.org. COVID protocols will be in effect. See you there.
All right. So we're back and we were just talking over the break a little bit about British Indian law and how that relates to American or federal Indian law now. So I think that you guys would be really interested to hear a little bit of that conversation. So we're going to bring it into the actual episode. So if you want to explain a little bit about what you were just telling me about on the break.
Yeah. So I was thinking about that question you had asked earlier in terms of what are aspects of history, and I think especially that colonial experience that, you know, Pamunkey people and other Virginia Indian people would want to foreground. And I began thinking about the role that Virginia, right, and Virginia and the tribes in Virginia that are negotiating these treaties with England, with the Virginia colonial government acting in its proxy, how important that was, obviously not just for our individual communities, but how it was completely instrumental in shaping the way that the United States developed Indian policy, right, moving forward. So in Virginia, which was kind of the epicenter in many ways of the British colonial world, was integral in shaping what Indian policy looked like in British colonial America. And what do I mean by that? Okay. I mean, treaty making was something, again, that the English did very early in Virginia. I think the earliest treaty is 1614. So treaty negotiations, the establishment of reserves or Indian territories, right, or reservations, that starts in Virginia, again, mm-hmm. through that engagement with the British colonial government. And all of these key players, like Thomas Jefferson, like George Washington, like Patrick Henry, again, all in Virginia, their treatment of what becomes federal Indian policy after the United States is established is all predicated on what they're doing in Virginia with indigenous communities in the Virginia colony. And I do want to mention too, like, you know, the Virginia colony, it's not the same boundaries today. Virginia went all the way to the Ohio River Valley. So that includes folks like the Miami, the Shawnee, the Cherokee, et cetera, the Tuscarora, before they joined the Six Nations, right? And all of these Powhatan specific tribes like the Pamunkey, the Chickahominy, the Rappahannock, et cetera, and Iroquoian speaking communities. So it's this rich place in terms of British colonial government interaction with indigenous communities from the Chesapeake Bay all the way into the Ohio River Valley. And it is instrumental to the ways in which the United States built its Indian policy. And I like to foreground that too, because I think it also gets at this perception that, well, you're not real Indians. You don't have treaties, quote unquote, you know, you don't have reservations, quote unquote. You didn't experience what other indigenous people experienced, you know, west of the Mississippi, you know, and I think it's unfortunate that we even have to like show that, yeah, we went through this hell too, to be considered legitimate. You know, it's really sad that we even have to do that. But I think it foregrounds the role that our like Native people in Virginia played in shaping not only federal Indian policy, again, but the history of the nation and how the United States perceives indigenous communities and how therefore it affects their movement westward and how they're going to engage in those communities moving forward. So that's just something that I wanted to mention, because I think it's important for folks to understand what was happening in Virginia and how that relates to this larger indigenous experience in the United States.
Yeah. That was a lot of good background information for me that I, you know, think I touched on in my federal Indian law and policy class in grad school, mm-hmm. but it's been a while, so it's always good to get a refresher. Yeah, so, okay, going from that and then to your work in Virginia after your PhD, mm-hmm. can you talk about where you went from there?
Yeah, definitely. So when I finished up with my PhD, I mean, and even before technically I finished my PhD, I was working heavily with the Pamunkey Indian tribe, a lot of it on a volunteer basis, just because of the resources we lacked. And, you know, again, also working to help secure funding for programs with the tribe. So some of the work that I was doing during the dissertation and then when I had finished was directing our museum. I kind of took over the reins of the Pamunkey Indian Museum and Cultural Center following my grandfather, I think in 2010. And I did that for about 8 years, worked with the museum, tried to you know, unfortunately, at that point when I took it over, it wasn't being upkept the way that it should. Folks in the tribe couldn't put as much focus as they would have liked to on upkeeping the museum because, like I said, we just didn't have the resources. So getting funding, you know, getting staff to help support those initiatives. But I would say one of the biggest projects I undertook after the dissertation was basically a nation building one. When I graduated from William & Mary with my PhD in 2017, and not even a year before that, we had actually, only 6 months actually before I graduated, our own federal recognition went into action in 2016, January of 2016. And I graduated that May in 2017. So I recognized right away that in order for us to really be able to take on this new status as a federally recognized tribe, that there was going to have to be a lot of groundwork that had to happen. And that groundwork was basically building up our governance structure and our administrative structure. Now, I do want to foreground that we have had a tribal government, again, since time immemorial. We have never not had a tribal government in place. So I want to foreground that. It's not like we had to create a government. We've always had a tribal governing body in place here on the Pamunkey Indian Reservation since it was established in 1646. But in order to have a government-to-government relationship with the United States and really take advantage of that trust relationship, we needed to build the infrastructure that was required to do that so that we could do it adequately. And we could do it to our best of our ability to help our people and serve our people. So I worked with who was now my business partner, Dr. Michelle Keel. Dr. Keel actually worked with Dr. John Moore to write our petition for federal acknowledgement. So that is how I met Dr. Keel. And Dr. Keel and I wrote an Administration for Native Americans Social and Economic Development Strategies grant, that is a mouthful, to basically fund and support the building of tribal capacity for the Pamunkey Indian tribe so that we could, again, fully take hold of this new status and use it to the best of our ability. So that's what I did for about 2.5 years. I managed that program. And what does that entail, right? A lot. So it included everything from administrative policy and procedure building to building key program areas like our natural resource management, our cultural resource management, our economic development enterprises and initiatives, all of that. It was about building all of that. And it's actually from that project and my work with Dr. Keel, who served as our consultant, that I decided that I would like to take these skills that I had learned through my work as an anthropologist and the skills that I was learning in these nation building initiatives for us to join together and partner and actually start doing this, helping other tribal nations do this as well. So, and that's how Kinna Consulting was born. You know, so that's what I do now. The Pamunkey Indian Tribe is still one of our clients. So I still work closely with my tribal community and I actually live on the reservation. So I'm a voting member. I engage in tribal politics. But the work that we do at Kinna Consulting, the range is varying in terms of the work that we do. But I do want to say that all of the work that we do, which is predominantly with tribal communities, or with institutions and organizations that want to serve or work with tribal communities, I guess our mission, our goal is to support tribal self-determination and tribal sovereignty, right? That is kind of at the core of everything we do. Even when we work with museums or universities, it's always geared towards the tribes having the ability to express that sovereignty through repatriation, for example. All of the tribal administrative capacity building projects that we do, again, is geared towards helping and supporting tribes express sovereignty and self-determination.
Tell us about the cultural resource management stuff.
One of the projects that we're working on with the Virginia tribes to help them build capacity following their new acknowledgement status
is helping them build cultural management strategic plans. So basically, obviously, all of these tribes are overwhelmed at the moment. And a lot of these other issues like cultural resource management, natural resource management, kind of start to take a back seat, even though, especially in parts of Virginia, you know, in Northern Virginia and the Tidewater region of Virginia, like Norfolk and Hampton, there is a lot of infrastructure and development projects going on. And so there's a lot of Section 106 with the National Historic Preservation Act going on, NAGPRA. We have a lot of, you know, Department of Defense, military bases, naval bases, right, in Virginia. So there's a lot of government to government consultation that is going on in the state, and the tribes need help in building the capacity to deal with not only cultural resource management off, you know, tribal lands, but also what they're doing to manage them on their tribal lands. So, and this is also an example of an outside organization wanting to help tribal communities. So one of my team members, her name is Lisa Bergstrom, who works with Kenneth Consulting. She and I have been working with a nonprofit organization called Preservation Virginia. And they wanted to do something that would support the Virginia Indian communities. And so, and talking with Virginia Indian communities, this was kind of a need among them, is their preservation, cultural heritage management, cultural resource management issues and needs. So we are working with five of the federally recognized tribes to develop cultural resource management strategic plans tailored to each tribal community's needs. So that's something that we've been working on very specifically, you know, that addresses their capacity building projects among the different tribes. And they range, of course, from one tribe to the next. We have one tribe focusing on their museum, another tribe focusing on developing an indigenous map of their ancestral lands, to another tribe building an educational program for their tribal members and for the public to learn about the history and culture of the tribe. So that's just a little bit of a, you know, a snippet of some of the very specific capacity building work that we do for tribes, and especially here in Virginia. We also do federal acknowledgement projects as well. As I mentioned, Dr. Keel wrote the petition for acknowledgement for the Pamunkey Indian Tribe, and we are working with several clients on their federal acknowledgement petitions. Again, you know, the whole purpose of federal acknowledgement is for that tribe who exists to be able to have the ability to be recognized by the federal government, so that they have, and I'm not saying that the federal government gives them sovereignty or gives them self-determination, but unfortunately, it is the avenue through which that can be expressed. And it is the avenue through which tribes can be at the table when it comes to issues like NAGPRA, or the National Historic Preservation Act, and other federal regulatory processes where tribes can be at the table. That status is key. That status is key to them having access to funding for programming to serve their people. So again, at the foundation of it, it's about self-determination and sovereignty. That also goes for the land into trust work that we do and the natural resource rights work that we do. You know, I'm not going to mention a ton of clients that we work with, because some of this work is, you know, that we're not here to tout, you know, our clients. We're just here to tout the foundational work that we do for the clients. But again,
right.
The natural resource work, the land into trust work, again, is all about supporting self-determination and sovereignty. And 99% of the work and programs and projects that we do is also about building tribal capacity within that area. We always work to get funding to support tribal members to work alongside us so that they can be trained, so that when we are no longer there as consultants, they have folks in place who can help carry that work on. One of our sayings is that we want to work ourselves out of a job. we don't want to need us, right? So, like I said, most of the work that we do is always has some kind of component where we're working with tribal members directly from those nations to help them build capacity, and so that they can have folks that can do that work themselves
within their tribal community. So even though we do a wide ranging type of work and a various types of work, the clients that we work with, again, majority tribal communities, and even those that are not tribal communities, but are trying to work with tribal communities, again, supporting sovereignty and self-determination is at the heart of all of the work that we do and everything that we do.
Yeah. And so just to kind of like sum up basically what you do based on what you were talking about and then looking at your website, I mean, it sounds like basically you guys do federal acknowledgement, you help with land claims and natural resource rights, cultural heritage work, and tribal historic preservation office building, I guess, capacity building. Mm-hmm. General capacity building for tribes and administration, and then also grant writing, like to help tribes get funding for programs that can enhance their self-determination. Does that sound like a good summary of the kind of stuff that you guys do?
Exactly. Yeah, that is a great summary of the work that we do.
Yeah, and it like I mentioned in the last break too, it reminds me a lot of the nation building after federal recognition episode. So if anyone's interested in hearing another example of what it's like to do the kind of work that you guys do, building nation building after federal recognition, in addition to all the other different types of work that you do, that's another good episode to listen to as an example.
One thing that I would mention too, and talking about like, you know, tribal capacity building, a lot of the work that we do is focused in Virginia. And again, that is because just within the past 4 years, Virginia has 7 newly federally recognized tribes, including my own. So there's a huge need in the state of Virginia alone with helping these tribal communities build that capacity. So we have had the honor of working with several of these Virginia-based communities and doing that. And it's so important too, because a lot of people don't understand the differences between, you know, a state versus a federally recognized tribe. And you know, for so long, we have only been recognized officially, quote unquote, by the state of Virginia, right? And with this new status, now we have the ability to actually express that sovereignty on a whole new level. And we need the mechanisms and the infrastructure and the support to do that. And it's massively overwhelming task. I mean, it's literally, like you said, nation building. Can you even begin to imagine all of the working parts that go into building a nation and setting up a government?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a massive undertaking. It's massively overwhelming. And I say that because I was literally in the middle of it within my own tribal community for some time. And you know, that's why, for example, helping with tribal historic preservation, and again, this is my wheelhouse personally, being an anthropologist. So tribal historic preservation, cultural resource management, engaging with the federal government and consultations on things like NAGPRA and the NHPA. You know, the tribes in Virginia have never had a seat at the table for that, really. So where do they even start with that? And so that's kind of where Kinna Consulting kind of comes in to help with that building of that policy and procedure development, that getting access to the resources that are going to help get them the capacity so that they're not overwhelmed. And I just have to say personally that, you know, I am honored to be able to be in the position to help. And that's really honestly the reason why I got into the field to begin with, is I want to service my community. I want to service Native people, because as an Indigenous person, I know the struggles. I know the challenges that our communities face. And I want to be able to help us be better and to get the support and the services that we need for our people. And you know, and I just chose to do that through anthropology, which I know some people are probably scratching their heads as to why. Why would you go through the field of anthropology of all places to do that? but I think it served me well, and it led to me to where I am today, and doing the work that I'm doing today to help tribal nations. And I'm honored and I'm humbled to be able to have the privilege to do that.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I have to say that you are Superwoman. I mean, you're running this consulting firm and it's July of 2020. So you have, you know, your kids at home and you have your dog and you have your husband working in the medical field right now. So yeah, that's amazing. It's amazing all the work that you do.
Well, thank you. And I don't feel like Superwoman. I feel like an exhausted human being, but which I know I'm not alone in that, especially right now. No. And I'm sure, you know, folks can probably hear my baby crying in the background. But yeah, you know, it is what it is. It's the new normal. And I would be lying if I said that COVID-19 hasn't impacted our work. Unfortunately, it has. And it's definitely impacted me personally, and having the ability to focus the time that I normally would have to this work. But like you said, I've got children at home and I just, you know, I don't have the personal capacity at the moment to be on top of it all. But I am again, blessed to be able to still be working throughout this time and doing some good work. So,
yeah. And not just children, a new baby.
Yes.
Yes. Not even just, you know, older children. That's amazing.
Well, thank you.
Cool. Yeah, of course. Well, where can our listeners find you if they're interested in learning more, or maybe their tribe could you use your guys' services? Where's a good place to find you?
Right. So the best place to get a hold of us is at Kenna. It's K-E-N-A-H consulting.com. And I do want to mention that Kenna is actually a Powhatan Algonquin word for thankfulness, for gratitude. And it's just kind of a nod to our clients to say thank you and that we are gracious that we've been able to have the chance to work with you. So I do want to mention that. But KennaConsulting.com, you can also, you'll see that we have an email address that you can reach us there. We've also got a resources page for tribal members and also just institution organizations who want to work with tribal communities. So please check that out. We've got a large list of resources that could help in a varying, you know, amount of ways. You can also get in touch with me directly, you know, through email at aaspivey, S-P-I-V-E-Y at kennaconsulting.com. And I know, Jessica, you will put some of that information up for folks to be able to reach out to me directly if they'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, these resources look great. I'm definitely excited to keep checking them out. So everybody else, check them out as well, because it looks like there's some good stuff in here. So anyway, thank you again so much for taking the time, especially right now with everything that's happening and, you know, growing your company and COVID and working from home. So I really, really appreciate it. And yeah, thank you for Kenna.
Well, thank you so much for reaching out to me and asking me to be a part of this podcast. I always welcome the chance to share not only the history and culture and of my tribal community, the Virginia tribal communities, but definitely sharing the work that I do. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to do that. I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.